How different does American history look through the lens of its Hispanic past? Historian Felipe Fernandez Armesto joins us to talk about his new book, Our America, A Hispanic History of the United States.
I think people in the United States have got to rethink themselves into embracing Latin America as not just the backyard, but part of the mansion.
Why should Americans care about Roger Ailes? Gabriel Sherman is here to talk about the subject of his new book, The Loudest Voice in the Room, How the Brilliant, Bombastic Roger Ailes Built Fox News and Divided the Country.
While there are the talking heads who are the public voices of Fox, the entire message, the entire ethos of the network ends and begins with him.
Julie Bosman is here with Notes from the Field, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul.
This episode is brought to you by BookBub, a service that helps readers discover high-quality ebooks they'll love at a great price. Go to bookbub.com/NYT to get alerts on free and discounted ebooks.
Felipe Fernandez Armesto is joining us from London. His new book, Our America, A Hispanic History of the United States, reviewed in this week's issue by Julio Ortega. Hi, Felipe.
Hello, Pamela. Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So you have written a number of books looking at American history and Hispanic history here. What is the idea behind this book? What's different?
A history of America kind of sideways on from south to north instead of following the usual trajectory from east to west, from sea to shining sea, following the colonization of what is now the United States by white Anglo-Saxon Protestant settlers and their cronies and slaves. Starting on the eastern seaboard. So instead, I can turn the history of the United States sideways and look at the making of the United States from south to north by Spanish colonists and settlers. It's a way of looking at the period of white Anglo-Saxon Protestant supremacy in the United States as a brief blip
right.
in a long Hispanic story which started before the Anglo settlers got there, and which is now continuing, and you know, the United States is kind of reverting to what I would say is its normal state as a very significantly, substantially, perhaps even preponderantly in the future Hispanic country.
You tell a great anecdote in your introduction that takes place in Colorado Springs. Tell us that to listeners.
Well, that was kind of starting point for the book. I mean, that's what really made me write it. When I was giving a lecture at the U.S. Air Force Academy, a very nice young Air Force officer was deputed to look after me, and we had some really interesting chats, and he was very broad-minded, well-educated, broadly cultured young man, and he actually, you know, sort of told me he was a liberal, and he was in favor of immigration, which, you know, as a sort of foreigner trying to live in the United States struck me as very kind of him. But he said, he had one reservation. He said, when people come to this country, they must learn the native language. And since I didn't think he was speaking about Ute or Comanche, I said, yes, I quite agree. Everybody should learn Spanish. And he looked at me strangely, and I said, excuse me, but what is this state called? And since we were in Colorado Springs, in the state of Colorado, that was kind of the end of the conversation. It made me realize, you know, that there are lots of really well-educated and very reasonable, well-disposed people in the United States who just don't realize that the country has this very long Hispanic past, and the present, you know, kind of situation isn't something kind of new, and it's not just the result of immigration. It's something very deeply etched in the history of the country, which everybody can be happy with and proud of and feel patriotic. I say it, use the American word patriotic about.
In your last chapter, this is you have a very straightforward subtitle, Why the United States Is and Has to Be a Latin American Country. So I'm assuming that this sort of laying out of history explains the reasoning behind that future.
Yes, I suppose that's right. It is a historical, it's an inference from the history of the country and all the common features it shares with other parts of the Americas. But it's also about the future of the United States, because I feel kind of uneasy about, you know, coming over to America as a foreigner and kind of telling you what your country is like. But you know, in a way, being a foreigner does help you to make kind of objective judgments.
You worked for Tocqueville.
And see the country differently. And the way I see it, I think, you know, might be helpful. And in particular, I think it's very helpful to realize that if the United States is going to be a great country in the future, if it's going to adjust, you know, to the post-American century, to a world in which the United States isn't going to be the only global superpower, if you're going to continue to be in that new world, the great country that the United States ought to be, you can only do it in collaboration with your neighbors in the Americas, because, you know, in the 19th century, the United States rose to global greatness because it had vast untapped resources. It had, you know, the prairies to turn from desert into wheat land. It had these huge, you know, huge unexploited aquifers, vast mineral wealth, enormous amounts of oil. I mean, really, you've come to the end of all that. You haven't got any more resources left within the United States. And the big, you know, unexploited resources in the hemisphere are obviously in Canada and in the Amazonian region and in the Chilean and Argentinian Antarctic. So in order to, you know, guarantee part of that future, I think people in the United States have got to rethink themselves into embracing Latin America as not just, you know, the back yard, but part of the mansion.
The rethinking, I think, begins even just looking at your table of contents, because this is it's a narrative history of the United States. But all of the points that most Americans use as kind of their reference points on the timeline, the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, aren't on your timeline. You've divided your history into very different periods from the expected Anglo telling of American history.
Oh, sure. Well, of course. Although, you know, I mean, clearly the American Revolutionary War and the Civil War are still, you know, absolutely critical. But I guess that I kind of downplay the conventional chronology, not only to foreground Hispanic experience, but also because, I mean, I tend to downplay everything conventional. You know, I mean, I don't think there's any point in writing a book unless, you know, you can do something a bit different from other books, and you know, kind of challenge people to think about what they already know in a new way. So in this history of the United States, the great events, the famous heroes, don't really have a big place. It's much more about kind of ordinary people's experience, and you name most of the individuals on whom I dwell, I'm sure, won't be familiar to even to very well educated Americans. You know, there are stories of guys like Miguel Quintana, you know, who's this sort of mystical poet who's scratching a living from a very, you know, poor piece of farmland in 18th century New Mexico. There's Agnes Morley Cleveland, the wonderful, you know, female pioneer in late 19th century New Mexico, who's very sympathetic to her Spanish neighbors. And of course, you know, there are lots and lots of stories of poor immigrants and their travails, their experiences, and their sufferings, which are moving and impassioning stories. And they're really, you know, in my way of looking at the country, they're really central to, crucial to, critical to the making of what America is today.
Tell us a little bit about one of those, one of your favorite characters in the book, and what that person's story
I think Miguel Quintana, whom I mentioned a moment ago, is the person in the book whom I most warmed to and loved, whom I would, you know, love to be able to conjure his up his presence so that I could ask him more about his case. And he was a really interesting guy because he was very well educated and literate, but like so many early Hispanic settlers in what's now the United States, he was seeking a more elevated role in society. He was seeking an acceptance world, a world in which he could, you know, really contribute something distinguished. And so he left his home in Mexico and sought a life on the frontier, where he was the town clerk and another scribe of the church. But he began having these experiences of God, in which God spoke to him, and he wrote them up in poetry, and he showed them to the local priests. So there was a succession of local priests who obviously, you know, loved him, admired him, and appreciated him. But eventually, you know, one of them became less enthusiastic about him than the others, referred his case to the Inquisition, and that was, you know, the beginning of his terrible sufferings, and he ended up having to suppress his voice. And that's sort of tragedy, not only for him, but also in a way for American history, because, you know, he was, in a sense, he was, you know, the first really ambitious writer of literature in Spanish on the mainland soil of what's now the United States. But his voice was cut short.
Where did you do most of the research? Where are the archives of these original materials that I imagine much of which is in Spanish?
Readers of the book can read a lot of this stuff for themselves, even if they don't read Spanish, because the works of Miguel Quintana have been translated and published in a monograph about him. And almost all the interviews that I've drawn on, most of which were conducted by sociologists and some by historians, they're all in print, and I think most of them are available in English translation. I mean, if anybody's kind enough to read the book and takes an interest in any of this material, it's very easy to follow up, and all the sources are given in the footnotes.
You call this an Hispanic history of America, whereas many Americans, Spanish-speaking Americans, refer to themselves as Latino. But you explain that usage.
For me, you know, I want people to call themselves what they like. You know?
Right.
I think sometimes in the United States, people are much too prescriptive, you know, in telling people who they are. It's up to each of us to decide who he or she is and to choose the names, the labels that suit us. And obviously for me, Hispanic makes better sense than Latino, because I'm Spanish, and so Latino doesn't include me, but I check the, you know, the Hispanic box when I'm filling in forms in the United States. I feel sympathy with, I want to belong to the same community as my fellow Hispanics. And, you know, all of these labels have really been imposed from the outside. The name Hispanic was thought up by the U.S. government. The name Latino was really thought up by a bunch of U.S. academics. So, you know, they're all of these labels are equally questionable, and I'm very happy for people to use whatever labels they want about themselves.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. That was Felipe Fernandez Armesto talking about his new book, Our America, A Hispanic History of the United States. It's reviewed this week by Julio Ortega in the Book Review. Felipe, thank you so much.
On the contrary, Pamela, it's really nice of you to think of me and take an interest in my book.
I'm sure listeners and readers will as well.
Thanks so much.
This episode is brought to you by BookBub. BookBub alerts you to free and discounted ebooks in genres that match your interests. Every book is hand-selected by BookBub's editorial experts from over 20 categories, including bestsellers, mysteries, romance, biography, science fiction, historical fiction, and nonfiction. BookBub works with the Kindle, iPad, Sony, Android, and more. BookBub subscribers have downloaded over 25 million ebooks. Sign up for BookBub for free in less than 30 seconds by entering your email address and what kind of books you like. Go to bookbub.com/NYT. That's bookbub.com/NYT to get free and discounted ebooks.
Julie Bosman is here to tell us about what's going on in the publishing world. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Pamela.
So the stores have broken out their Valentine's merch, and you have an appropriate subject today.
Are we at Valentine's Day already?
It's already in stores, in my local CVS.
Oh, right. The pink aisle. Well, in the publishing world, this was, I guess, an appropriately timed news development this week. 2012, as everyone in the book business knows, was all about 50 Shades of Grey and all of the other romance novels and erotica that came along with it. And St. Martin's Press has just made a very big acquisition, and they seem to believe that there is still a lot of appetite for romance novels.
And the author in question is?
The author in question is Sylvia Day, and she is a romance writer who's been writing for at least 10 years. She's written 20 books at this point, but she's most well known for a series called Crossfire. And that series was published in 2012 and early 2013. And there were three books in this series. They probably stick in your head because they looked a lot like 50 Shades of Grey. Berkeley Books, part of Penguin, published these books, and they were clearly trying to create some kind of connection between the 50 Shades of Grey books, which had, you know, black covers and, you know, close up of, you know, a silver tie or, you know, other close up objects. And the Sylvia Day series had dark covers with a close up of, say, a shiny pair of gold cufflinks. So if you went into a bookstore in 2012 or 2013, you probably saw 50 Shades of Grey, and you probably also saw Sylvia Day's series that was sitting right next to it on the shelf.
And the new deal is with St. Martin's. Is it for another trilogy, or are these standalones?
So she has jumped from Berkeley Books to St. Martin's, and St. Martin's has agreed to pay an 8-figure advance for her next two books. So I guess we can call that a series if two books can comprise a series. And so at least $5 million each book. They wouldn't be more specific than that. These books tell the story of a couple in Manhattan, a young couple. She is a student at Columbia and he's a student at Fordham. And these books are going to come out sometime in 2015. After the fourth and fifth books in the Crossfire series are released by Penguin.
So that series isn't done yet?
That series is not done yet. Penguin has not placed a pub date on the fourth and fifth books of the Crossfire series, which they acquired some time ago. But the first three books in the series have sold more than 13 million copies.
Wow. Here's a question. Are these romance novels? Are they erotica? How are these categorized?
Well, people who know the romance and erotica categories very well will jump up and down screaming when people lump them together. And while 50 Shades of Grey is certainly erotica, these books were described to me as more of romance.
Erotic romance.
Right. So there is a distinction. And I think that the popular press is often accused of kind of marginalizing the whole category and lumping it all together. But St. Martin's Press says that they think that Sylvia Day really has the potential and already is more of a crossover writer, that her books shouldn't be lumped into a narrow category, and that she really has the potential to be someone who has mass commercial appeal, more of a Janet Ivanovich or John Grisham or James Patterson, or someone who really attracts people who don't necessarily read romance as a specific genre.
Well, I guess the Valentine's season, if that's now a thing, is starting early for her. Thanks, Julie.
Thanks.
Hi, this is John Williams, an editor at The Times, and I'm here with Gabriel Sherman, who is the author of The Loudest Voice in the Room, How the Brilliant, Bombastic Roger Ailes Built Fox News and divided a country. It's reviewed for us this week by Jacob Weisberg, who calls it an actually fair and balanced, carefully documented biography. And Gabriel Sherman is here to talk about it. Hi, Gabe.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in. You know, for the average viewer of Fox News, it's possible that, you know, they think of Rupert Murdoch, obviously, as a very big business titan with Fox, and they think of the on-air personalities like Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity. But who is Roger Ailes? Just give us the basic story of his role with Fox and when he began there and what he did there.
Well, Roger Ailes is the chairman and CEO of Fox News. He's the founder of the network. He launched it on October 7th, 1996. He was hired by Rupert Murdoch after Ailes had left NBC, where he had been the head of CNBC, the business news channel, and a fledgling cable talk channel called America's Talking. To understand Fox News, you have to understand that Roger Ailes is the creative vision behind the network. While there are the talking heads who are the public-facing voices of Fox, the entire message, the entire ethos of the network ends and begins with him. The agenda gets set in his morning news meetings. The colors, the graphics, the look, the speed of the network, everything is a reflection of his worldview and his television talents, which extend all the way back to his early days as a executive producer of the Mike Douglas Show in the 1960s.
And he still sort of keeps a very close eye on all of those things.
Makes Roger Ailes unrivaled in the TV news business is his technical skills as a producer. And it's those skills, just his eye for the camera, the look. You know, there's a famous story that Roger Ailes would pick talent for Fox News by watching tapes of prospective anchors with the volume off. And while it might strike some as strange that he wouldn't want to hear what they have to say, his thought is that you can see a lot about a person by how they leap through the screen. And he wants his anchors to connect to the viewers on an emotional level. And so that is, he looks for these authentic personalities. And that is what has helped make Fox News a phenomenon.
And so over the years, from the sort of biggest names on air to the smaller role people, he has very carefully picked them himself. There aren't any Fox stars who have become stars without his.
I think the exception to that would be Bill O'Reilly. You know, Bill O'Reilly is a talented television performer in his own right, and he's the one talent that executives at Fox News told me that really is a self-made man. He had kind of flamed out of his TV career, had pursued a master's degree at Harvard University, and when Ailes hired him in 1996, he was washed out and kind of remade himself as this populist cultural vigilante speaking for the kind of cultural conservatives out there in America. So, but everyone else on Fox, from the morning anchors on Fox and Friends to Sean Hannity in primetime, really owe their success to Ailes' decision to pick them and build shows around their personalities.
And when did he first get into TV? And did he always sort of eye it as a medium for politics or something that he was going to wed those two things?
Well, Roger Ailes is a child of television. He grew up in the 1940s and 50s in Northeast Ohio, right when television was becoming replacing radio as the mass medium for Americans. And he majored in broadcasting at Ohio University, which had a pioneering communications department. From there, he landed on the Mike Douglas Show as a prop boy, which was a daytime TV show first produced out of Cleveland at KYW-TV. Ailes was a kind of a fierce corporate politicker. And by the age of 26 and 27, he became the executive producer of the show. And it was there on the set of the Mike Douglas Show where he developed his interest in transferring the skills of television to politics.
And is this how he met Richard Nixon?
Yes. So this is a seminal anecdote episode in the book where Richard Nixon was booked as a guest on the Mike Douglas Show. And Ailes sought out Nixon. He stuck him in his office so he could corner him from a private conversation in an interview with a Mike Douglas colleague of his. This former producer told me how Ailes was captivated by the propaganda films of the Nazi filmmaker Leni Riefenstahl, and not for their ideology. I'll be clear, in no way was Ailes captivated by the ideology, but from her technical and creative talents, he saw how she used camera placements, camera angles to make her subjects appear more domineering and powerful on screen.
Right.
And he wanted to transfer those skills to American politics. And he talked his way into a job on the Nixon campaign. And it was in that moment in 1968 where he realized he had found his calling.
And so what do we learn about him from the Nixon years? How long did he work with him?
Well, he left the Douglas Show in August of 1968 and went to the Republican convention in Miami Beach. And it was on that campaign when Roger Ailes became a star, because by chance, a friend of his, the journalist Joe McGinnis, was chronicling the Nixon campaign in his landmark book, The Selling of the President.
Yeah.
And he was writing about the ad men and the handlers around Nixon. And Ailes emerged from that narrative as the most colorful and profane character. And that book made him a star. I mean, at the time, Roger Ailes was kind of a punk kid. He was not a key player. Ailes, as the charismatic young Turk, emerged from McGinnis's account as the true hero of that anti-hero slash hero of that story. And from there, his star was made.
In the Times, David Carr recently wrote about Ailes, that he clings to the role of a grieved underdog. You know, do you think that's accurate? What are the roots of that? And is he right? Mm-hmm. Is he in any way an aggrieved underdog?
That worldview was instilled in Roger Ailes from his earliest years growing up. His father was a frustrated factory foreman, worked at the Packard Automotive plant, didn't get a college education. His father was a resentful man. We know from his parents' divorce records that, according to his wife's legal claims, that he was a violent, vindictive man. And the other defining experience of Ailes' youth that instilled this underdog, me against the world philosophy was his illness. He grew up as a hemophiliac at a time when it was a serious medical condition. You know, the average life expectancy for serious hemophiliacs in his generation was between 10 and 15 years old. So the idea that life is fragile, that, you know, you have to fight for everything you have, was there from the beginning. And then as he got more powerful, it sort of became a pose that he used to always never back down. And at Fox, he has used it to rally his troops. And it's ironic in a way that Fox News is the most dominant cable network. Its ratings are double that of CNN and MSNBC. It generates $1 billion of profit. And yet Ailes makes his troops feel like they are waging a daily war against these more powerful forces.
Right. It's like those sports teams that have great seasons and still say no one believes in us. We're
exactly.
You know, we're the underdog. So there's this other narrative that, you know, that Ailes himself is you know, more moderate in his politics naturally than his audience is, and that sort of in a kind of Frankensteinian way, he's created, you know, a flank of the Republican Party that he doesn't really control anymore. Do you agree with that take on things?
You know, I think one of the big reveals of my book is that, in fact, Roger Ailes is more extreme than Glenn Beck. It's actually a testament to his ability to spin and massage his own life story that the wider perception may be that he's a moderate. I think what's true is that throughout his political career as a consultant, as a political operative in the 1980s, he worked mainly for moderates. His political hero is George H.W. Bush. But don't let his resume fool you. His own personal politics are far to the right, oftentimes far to the right of even where his Fox News hosts are. For example, his views on immigration are very extreme. I quote a scene in the book in which his solution to the immigration crisis would be to send Navy SEAL trainees to the southern border of the United States with direct orders to shoot and kill people trying to cross in illegally. His views in his hometown in Garrison, New York, he heard some local Chinese businessmen were thinking of buying a parcel of property that was across the Hudson River from West Point, and Ailes recounted to a local politician that he wasn't going to allow Chinese businessmen to buy the land because he feared they would build a missile silo and attack West Point. I mean, these are extreme kind of surprising views that he talks about in private. And my book, for the first time, reveals him for who he is. And there's no doubt that the politics on Fox are real. Mm-hmm. They begin and end with him. Ultimately, that was a problem for the 2012 election because the power of Fox to sort of brand the GOP as a voice of extreme populist politics was a turnoff to voters during an election when President Obama was eminently beatable. And yet, Mitt Romney was walking around talking like Sean Hannity, which was a turnoff to many voters.
Right, right. And in terms of that, you know, because there is that idea that in giving time to some of the people who maybe had very strong followings on the far right, but not the more moderate candidates, that Fox maybe hurt the chances of the GOP. But how much, and Ailes, we'll get to this in a minute, he didn't cooperate with your book, but how much do you get a sense that he's aware of that? Do you think that bothers him, that he might change in the future to go in a more moderate direction if he's that intent? Because you also make the point that he wants to sway the populace, according to your
research. I think that's what
makes
Ailes such a fascinating and compelling character, because in my narrative, at the end, he emerges as a man at war with himself. He has these competing interests. He wants to be a political kingmaker. He wants to be the most dominant cable news executive. And he also is a far-right extreme conservative. And so those three things are in tension with each other. But the one thing that Roger Ailes will never change is that throughout his career, he has demonstrated an ability to constantly deflect blame. And in the case of the 2012 election, he has said in meetings with his top executives, he blames the GOP for Mitt Romney's failures, not Fox's role in branding the GOP as hostile to science, hostile to immigration, hostile to gay marriage, you know, issues where the culture is kind of moving closer towards. Mm-hmm. And Ailes would say the GOP couldn't organize a one-car funeral. Or in another meeting, he said, Mitt Romney is like Chinese food. 20 minutes after you meet him, you can't even remember what you had. So he uses humor, and they're funny lines, but they're examples of how he shifts the blame.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see Ailes learning from this lesson of failure and tacking in a new direction. I mean, this is who he is. He's 73 years old, and Fox is an expression of him. And so I think what he will do is he'll shift blame and deflect his own role and his network's role in the party's failing fortunes.
Lastly, just because we touched on this a little bit, you write at length in the acknowledgments and other places about the fact that he didn't cooperate with the book. So talk a little bit about the difficulty that posed, and also, you know, any other difficulty you might have had in your years of research that didn't have to do with the fact that he was uncooperative. What was the sort of, you know, the most challenging thing for you outside of his silence, and even would you call it obstruction? Or
whether Ailes cooperated with me or not, it would not have changed the approach in the reporting of this book, because he is an unreliable narrator of his own life story, as many of us are. And so I wanted this book to be kind of the full accounting of his career and his influence on America through the historical record, primary documents, emails, letters, as well as, you know, oral testimony of the hundreds of people who have known him. And so whether he sat down with me or not, I needed to go out and do that reporting. I actually think his decision not to cooperate was, as I write in the note on sources, revealing, because a through line of his entire career has been his desire for control. He grew up in a traumatic household. He's had a debilitating medical condition. He's tried to create a safe place for himself in the world. And it's a metaphor for how Fox News is a cocoon. It's an entire organization that exists to make him feel in control. And so his decision not to sit down with me only confirmed my reporting even more. Hmm. Now, to the second point about challenges, the veil of secrecy and the omerta that exists inside Fox News is something I've never experienced as a reporter. You know, I've covered media now for a decade. I've written about the biggest media companies in the industry, including the New York Times, the Washington Post. I've covered Wall Street banks. These are, you know, not completely transparent institutions. And yet I had never experienced anything as secretive as Fox. The level of fear and paranoia that if Ailes found out a source was talking to me, people, and this is not an exaggeration, feared for their physical safety. I quote a document from an NBC investigation when Ailes was embroiled in a bitter power struggle in 1995, when he at the time was head of the CNBC business network. And one executive, David Zaslav, who's now the highest paid media executive in America, wrote a letter to NBC HR chief Ed Scanlon that he feared for his family's safety at home. I mean, these are not wilting flowers. These are seasoned business executives. And the fear that Ailes inspired is visceral and it's real. And so as a reporter, breaking through that and getting sources to open up was something I had never experienced. But that's why it took 3 years and all of this reporting to finally get in the room and show this secret world to readers.
Well, Ailes didn't talk, but a lot of other people did. And the result is the book, The Loudest Voice in the Room, How the Brilliant, Bombastic Roger Ailes Built Fox News and Divided a Country. Gabe Sherman, thanks for coming in to talk about it.
Thanks for having me.
Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list?
Really a lot of things this week. Right up at the top, on the hardcover side of things at Fiction, there's a new number one title. It's by Sumunk Kidd.
The Oprah effect.
Yeah, ever since The Secret History of Bees, she's just been a reader favorite. And her new novel, The Invention of Wings, which is about a white girl who gets a slave as a birthday present and develops a relationship with her, that debuts right at number one. Then we've got a stretch of series novels all hitting the list. At number three, Christine Feehan, who writes paranormal romances, has the 25th book in her Dark series. It's called Dark Wolf. These are about like vampire-type figures who, in fact, don't kill people. In fact, they have robust sex with them instead.
Ah, I thought you were going to say they kill wolves, but okay. Even better.
They do sometimes kill wolves and are killed by wolves, and they also kill vampires.
After they have sex.
Sometimes while they're having sex. Then at number four, another long-standing series, Stuart Woods has the 28th book in his Stone Barrington series. It's a novel called Stand Up Guy. That makes its debut at number four. Some more series at number seven, Bernard Cornwell, who's been working on a series about the founding of England back in the Middle Ages, The Warrior Chronicles. The seventh book in that series is called The Pagan Lord, and that's new on the list at number seven. Another series at number nine, Lisa Gardner's D.D. Warren series. The seventh book in her series is called Fear Nothing, and that's new on the list at number nine. And then a series writer who has a standalone book, Jane Ann Krentz's River Road, is new at number 10. As far as I can tell, that is not part of a series. It's just a new romantic suspense thriller from Jane Ann Krentz. That's it on the fiction side of things.
And then print hardcover nonfiction.
Yeah, also quite a bit of turnover on that list this week. Really, suddenly things are shaking up. The highest ranking new nonfiction title on the hardcover list this week is called Brainstorm. It's by a clinical psychiatrist from UCLA named Daniel J. Siegel. And it's a look at the teenage mind, not just the teenage mind, the adolescent mind. And he, in his view, adolescence extends from about age 12 all the way up to like age 24.
I thought you were going to say up into the early 40s. Darn.
Then at number eight, Gary Steingart's memoir, Little Failure, makes the list. He, of course, is a comic literary writer whose novels have been mainstays on the bestseller list. And now he's on the nonfiction side of things as well. Then at number nine, Scott Stossel, the editor of The Atlantic Monthly, has a memoir and kind of historical cultural study called My Age of Anxiety.
Which he says that basically everyone might have anxiety and therefore everyone is going to read it.
he talks a bit. He's in his 40s as well. And he talks a bit in there about growing up in the age of The Day After, the movie about the nuclear holocaust, and how during the Cold War and the wake of the Cold War, kind of we're all just conditioned to live with a cloud of anxiety hanging over our heads. Then at number 12, the journalist Jane Pauley has a book called Your Life Calling.
Yes.
And at number 14, the last new book on the hardcover nonfiction side of things, is written by the political consultants and husband and wife team of James Carville and Mary Madeline. He's a Democrat. She's a Republican. It's a book called Love and War.
All right. This is their second collaboration, isn't it?
At least their second,
At least their second collaboration. Okay. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.